Okay, well, today we begin a series in 1 Samuel, and I'd like to read the passage to you. Samuel, if you're not quite sure where it is, about maybe one-fifth into the Bible, you know, sometimes you just open it and it falls open, and if you're in Kings or Chronicles, you've just passed it. So you just need to back up a little bit. Samuel, Kings, and Chronicles. Years ago, when I memorized the books of the Bible, I just kind of came up with little acronyms and little words. So Sam was king of the crows. That kind of helped me to remember what order Samuel, Kings, and Chronicles went into. So just following the book of Ruth, we come to Samuel. And I'd like to read from the NIV this morning the first 20 verses. In my Bible, the heading is the birth of Samuel. There was a certain man from Ramathaim, a Zuphite from the hill country of Ephraim, whose name was Elkanah, son of Jeroham, the son of Elihu, the son of Tohu, the son of Zuph and Ephraimite. He had two wives. One was called Hannah and the other Peninnah. Peninnah had children, but Hannah had none. Year after year, this man went up from his town to worship and sacrifice to the Lord Almighty at Shiloh, where Hophni and Phinehas, the two sons of Eli, were priests of the Lord. Whenever the day came for Elkanah to sacrifice, he would give portions of the meat to his wife Peninnah and to all her sons and daughters. But to Hannah he gave a double portion because he loved her, even though the Lord had closed her womb. Because the Lord had closed Hannah's womb, her rival kept provoking her in order to irritate her. This went on year after year. Whenever Hannah went up to the house of the Lord, her rival provoked her till she wept and would not eat. Her husband, Elkanah, would say to her, "Hannah, why are you weeping? Why don't you eat? Why are you downhearted? Don't I mean more to you than 10 sons? Once when they were finished eating and drinking in Shiloh, Hannah stood up. Now Eli the priest was sitting on his chair by the doorpost of the Lord's house. In her deep anguish, Hannah prayed to the Lord, weeping bitterly. And she made a vow, saying, "Lord Almighty, if you will only look on your servant's mercy and remember me, and not forget your servant, but give her a son, then I will give him to the Lord for all the days of his life, and no razor will ever be used on his head." As she kept on praying to the Lord, Eli observed her mouth. Hannah was praying in her heart, and her lips were moving, but her voice was not heard. Eli thought she was drunk and said to her, "How long are you going to stay drunk? Put away your wine." "Not so, my Lord," Hannah replied. "I am a woman who is deeply troubled. I have not been drinking wine or beer. I was pouring out my soul to the Lord. Do not take your servant for a wicked woman. I have been praying here out of my great anguish and grief." Eli answered, "Go in peace, and may the God of Israel grant you what you asked of him." She said, "May your servant find favor in your eyes." Then she went on her way and ate something, and her face was no longer downcast. Early the next morning they arose and worshiped before the Lord, and then went back to their home at Ramah. Elkanah made love to his wife Hannah, and the Lord remembered her. So in the course of time, Hannah became pregnant and gave birth to a son. She named him Samuel, saying, "Because I asked the Lord for him." So we're beginning a new series today from the Old Testament. We're in the book of 1 Samuel. You probably know that originally 1 and 2 Samuel were just Samuel. But because putting all of that on one scroll, which was what the author of Samuel would originally have written on, the scroll would have just been too big. And so somebody got the bright idea, look, let's just cut it in half, and we'll call one Samuel, and we'll call one 2 Samuel. But they thought we would remember that it's really just Samuel. It's the story of Samuel and related events. So we're going to look at the first scroll, the book of 1 Samuel. In our family, we like to play games. I know there are good games that people play, and there are not so good games that people play. Sometimes we play games with one another that we shouldn't play, and sometimes we even play games with God, don't we? One of the games that we play with God, I think, as Canadians, is we imagine that God doesn't exist. Now, we don't actually say, "Oh, God, you don't exist," but deep down, that probably is the conviction of most of the citizens in our country. A number of years ago, Time magazine published an issue, and on it they had a question, a bold question. And the question was, is God dead? It was their way of responding to a trend that they saw in society, a trend where people tend to paint God out of the picture. I don't know if that expression means anything to you, to paint something out. A number of years ago, when we were getting our home painted, our ceiling was white, but there was a border of a non-white color on the ceiling. It was decided that we didn't want to retain that, and so we instructed the painter to just paint it out. So she painted it out. And now if you come into our home and you look up, there is no border. And that seems to be a fitting description of what we sometimes do with God. And I think Canadians have a real nasty habit of doing this, of just imagining that God doesn't exist. Of all the things that you could use your imagination for, and a number of weeks ago we looked at Philippians and some of the great things that we can hold in our imaginations. This is one of the worst ways of using your imagination, and that is to think that he doesn't exist. I think another game that we play with God is that we ignore his authority. It's not that we don't think that God exists. In fact, if you said, how many of you believe that God exists? All of our hands would go up. Yeah, I believe that God exists. But the breakdown comes when it comes to living our lives day to day, the way that we do business, the way that we conduct ourselves interpersonally, the things that we use our bodies for. Sometimes we're really saying, God, you may exist, but you're not an authority that I need to listen to and bow my life to and to shape my life around. There was a time in Israel's history when they did that a lot. Oh, they all knew that God existed. They believed that God existed, but they behaved in ways that suggested they didn't. There were many dark periods in Israel's history, but the one that we have in mind is found in the book of Judges. We're not looking at Judges today, but if you read through the book of Judges, it just gets darker and darker the further that you get. Right at the end of the book of Judges, the writer summarizes what life was like during that period. The last verse of the last chapter sums up the ethos of the day. And many of you know this verse off by heart. It goes, everyone did that which was right in their own eyes. That's what the country was like. And of course, we don't have to imagine very much to appreciate what it would be like living in a country like that, because that's often how we as Canadians conduct ourselves. Well, the amazing thing was that during this dark time of Israel's history, when it just seemed to get bleaker and bleaker, every once in a while, these exceptions to the rule would crop up. You know what it's like when you turn on a flashlight in a very, very dark room, how bright it looks. And that's what these exceptions looked like. One of them was a lady. She wasn't even a Jew. She was a Gentile. She was a Moabite woman, and her name was Ruth. And she was one of these amazing exceptions who, in spite of the fact that everybody was doing whatever they wanted to do, doing their own thing, living the way that they wanted to live, she chose to live a different way. And then the other great exception, and there are others besides these two, was a man by the name of Samuel. And so today we want to begin looking at this man whose life really was this amazing exception to how everybody in the culture seemed to be living. I hope that by looking at his life and looking at the lives of others who seem to be similar exceptions to the rule, that some of that will leak into our lives. And increasingly, we here at Balmoral will be exceptions to the rule. Well, where does Samuel fit into the Bible? I know that's a Terry question. I think about these things. I wonder about these things. I think most of us realize that an important part of the storyline of the Bible focuses on what God is doing to put things right. Ever since the fall in the garden, when our first father and mother rebelled against God, remember, they had these great permissions, and then they had this single restriction, and they crossed that boundary. And when they did, I'm sure they had no sense of the damnation that they were bringing upon themselves. They pulled a curse over themselves and their posterity and even creation itself. Well, ever since, God has been busy at work putting things right. And so Samuel fits somewhere in this part of the storyline where God is bringing everything back online. And as you read through Samuel with kind of big picture lenses. I think most of us were taught well in Sunday school how to think in terms of the individual stories, and that's an important part of understanding Samuel. There is a time when we just need to step back and say, what really is going on in Samuel? When we do that, there's a number of shifts. One writer referred to these as tectonic shifts. There are movements. These are advances. It's like the author is waving a flag and saying, look what God is doing. He is really taking matters into his own hands to make sure that things are moving in the direction of being right. And three of them that you can observe are, Israel moves from a time when they were ruled by judges to a time when they were ruled by a single king. The book of Judges, of course, is about all of these warlords, some of them good, many of them not so good. These are people that each had a tribe that they served, but by the time you get to the end of 2 Samuel, you don't have these judges anymore. You have a king, a monarchy. That's a pretty big change to how they govern themselves, or not govern themselves, but how their country was governed. Another shift that we see is from a place of worship. When Samuel begins, they're worshiping in a single sacred site. Kind of an obscure area by the name of Shiloh. But by the time you get to the end of Samuel, they're no longer worshiping in a little sacred site. They're worshiping in a sacred city. A city that one day will contain this impressive piece of architecture. A temple that will house the presence of the living God. So that's kind of a shift in where and how they worshiped. And then the other one is that they move from being a floundering nation to being this major world player. At the beginning of Samuel, you're never quite sure what's going to happen to Israel. Like they win battles, they lose battles, they win battles, they lose battles, and often it looks like they're going to get swallowed up by the Canaanites or the Philistines. Well, by the time you get to the end of Samuel and just into 1 Kings, they are this major world empire that other countries recognize and want to establish diplomatic relations with. One time, the king of Egypt, Pharaoh, felt so strongly about the importance of being on good terms with this powerful neighbor, Israel, that he offered his daughter in marriage to Solomon. And that was kind of a way of cementing a relationship, a diplomatic relationship between these two countries. Part of the thinking was probably like, you know, if my daughter marries your son, like, we're not going to go to war. Like, as in-laws, we don't want to fight with each other, right? And there were other benefits that would come from that kind of a relationship. So in less than 150 years, Israel went from being this floundering collection of tribes to being consolidated under a single king and being a major world player. Something's going on. So some pretty impressive things happening, and I think that helps us to understand the role of Samuel in the Bible. God is restoring a world in ruins, including the fortunes of his people. And I think whenever we read the Bible, we always need to sort of that ground level understanding all the individual stories, but then we need to step back sometimes and think about the big picture and what's happening in God's larger program. Playing games with God, placing Samuel in the Bible. Well, what about the book itself? How does it actually begin? When the writer of Samuel, we're not quite sure who it is because the book's actually anonymous, when he starts telling us about Samuel, where does he begin the story? What's the first episode that he wants us to look at? Well, we've already read the passage, and I think you'll appreciate that it starts on a rather dramatic note with a piece of family drama. We all know about family drama. There may have been some dramas today en route to church. I know there were in our family when the kids were younger. And during the week, sometimes there's drama that goes on in our families. And the families in the Bible are no exception to that. And so in the first two verses, the writer introduces us to the background to Samuel. And he describes the plight of a Middle Eastern woman. And initially, he just tells us the sort of information that you would expect in a Jewish story. Here's a man. This is where he's from. Here are his ancestors. Here's his name, and so on. This is where he lives. This is the tribe that he's connected with. And, you know, it's really no big deal. Where's the drama and all that? But then he comes to verse 2, and he tells us that Elkanah, the man that he's talking about, had two wives. Now, we evangelicals at this point think, ah, that's the drama, polygamy. But that's not actually the drama that the author focuses on. He keeps going, and he identifies his two wives, Hannah and Peninnah. And you say, oh, there's the drama, two wives. Well, no, that's not actually the drama. You have to go right to the end of the sentence when he says, Peninnah had children and Hannah had none. The plight of a Middle Eastern woman who was barren was serious. Now, in our culture, it's serious, but in their culture, it was even more serious. Infertility is a modern issue. It's not just an ancient issue. There are many, many women in Canada, what is it, 1 in 6, who are affected by infertility. Now, that means that in all of our families, in all likelihood, there are people who have been touched by infertility. In our congregation, there are women and families whose lives have been touched by infertility. In my family, my extended family, I have a sister who for years, her and her husband tried to have children and were unable to. Other family members, this is a real struggle. Never gets talked about. This is just one of those things, you know. How do you talk about this? How do you bring this up at prayer meeting? This is a very personal issue in modern times, but in ancient times, it was even more, in a sense, it was more significant because it rendered a woman vulnerable in ways that a woman today isn't vulnerable. For instance, it jeopardized the family inheritance. You know, the land keeps getting handed down from generation to generation, but then you marry a woman who's unable to have children. And for whatever reason, you're not about to get another woman. You're just going to, you know, accept monogamy. This is the way God planned it. And so this is the way it's going to be. But you're not producing any children. And so eventually your family name is going to die off and the inheritance will go somewhere else. It'll go to somebody else. And that was a pretty big deal in an agrarian society. So that was one of the reasons why this was quite dramatic. Another reason why it was dramatic is because the Bible itself said that one of the signs of the blessing of God in a family is the presence of what? Psalm 127 makes it pretty clear. Children. The more children, the more blessing. The more blessing, the more children. And so what conclusion are we to draw if a woman, in fact, was unable to produce children? And the rabbis talked about this and they discussed this, but at the end of the day, whether officially or not, there was a stigma that was attached to a woman who couldn't bear children for that reason. And then another reason why this was so serious is in a polygamous relationship, of course, she could easily now be the object of great bullying. And that's what happened in this story. In verses 3-8, the writer continues by showing the suffering that barren Hannah experiences. He begins year after year. Verse 7, this went on year after year, this bullying, this interpersonal antagonization. I mean, it was awful. Now, interestingly, this would come to a head annually in connection with a religious festival. It's funny how sometimes the worst of family comes out during holy holidays. You know, you get together for Christmas, right? And if it was just you and your wife, it might be fine. But then the kids are there, and then they bring their friends, and, you know, maybe Uncle Harry comes and other family members. And then there's history between you, and sometimes things can go a little bit sideways, right? Well, this is kind of what happened. Whenever they went to Shiloh for this annual religious festival, and they would do their worshiping, and they would do their sacrificing, and then part of the festivities included a meal, and the animal that had been sacrificed, it was the duty of the head of the family, in this case Elkanah, it was his duty to divvy up the meat to each family member, and he would do that. Everybody got a nice portion, except what happened when he got to Hannah. Is it verse 5? But to Hannah, he gave a double portion. He gave her twice as much meat. Why did he give her twice as much meat? Well, it continues because he loved her. That is, he loved her twice as much. Elkanah had a favorite. I'm sure conventional wisdom in the day would have said, look, if you're going to have two wives, you know, don't pick a favorite. It's like when you have children. Conventional wisdom is don't pick favorites. And if you've got a favorite child, which most of us do, if you've got a favorite child, keep it to yourself. Well, he had a favorite wife, and even though God had closed her womb, even though she wasn't producing family, he favored her, and it showed by the size of the portion that he gave her at the sacrificial meal. Well, the rival wife wasn't about to take this on the chin, right? She knew that providentially that Hannah was not able to have children. And rather than saying, oh, you know, rather than empathizing with her, oh, this is, oh, how can I encourage you? How can I help you? What can I do? And instead of doing that, it says that her rival kept provoking her in order to irritate her. That went on year after year. They get together for this big religious festival. Everything is supposed to be sweet and good and God-focused and loving one another, but that's not what's happening. Well, you say, well, this was just a very dysfunctional polygamous family. Well, that's probably true. By the way, if you're ever interested in watching a dramatic sort of presentation of what it would be like to live in a modern-day polygamous family, HBO a number of years ago produced a series called Big Love. I don't have cable, so I've never been able to watch it, but I've heard it paints a pretty accurate picture of some of the difficulties that you would encounter if you had, in this case, a guy had three wives. So, I haven't seen Big Love, but if you get a chance to see it, it might give you some insight into some of the struggles and conflicts that they faced year after year. So her rival, Peninnah, she responds with nasty, retaliation. She's angry because Elkanah doesn't think she's his favorite wife. He favors her. And, she provokes Hannah and she weeps and she weeps and she's depressed and she's discouraged to the point where she loses her appetite. This is really wrecking her life. This is really messing with her life. I was trying to think the other day of, how would she do this? What would Peninnah be saying to Hannah that would be upsetting? And, just immediately a number of lines, some sort of dialogue came to me, some digs, and I realized I can't say any of them in church. Even though that what you would just, naturally understand, these are things that you could say. They would just be so painful and so nasty that I don't want to say any of them, right openly. If you want to talk to me later, we can exchange taglines that we use, but I don't think it takes a lot of imagination to appreciate that Peninnah could really have hurt Hannah. Well, to make matters worse, in verse 8, Elkanah, he thinks he's going to be helpful, and this isn't the first time in the book of Samuel. You read what a person says and you think, what was he thinking? What is it with guys in Samuel? They're trying to be helpful, but look what he says. Her husband Elkanah would say to her, Hannah, why are you weeping? Duh. Why don't you eat? Why are you downhearted? And then the real goofy line, the really lame comfort, don't I mean more to you than 10 sons? And I was trying to figure out, how would that come out in modern parlance? And the best I could think of was something like, Hannah, who needs babies, baby, when you've got me? Or something like that. And of course, there's absolutely no comfort to be had there. But what is obvious to us is that her childlessness was very real and it was very painful. And I was reflecting this week on some of the people that I know for whom this is an issue, and I was reminded that childlessness actually comes in a variety of shapes and sizes. I mean, there's the obvious, Hannah. I received an email last week from a friend of mine. I used to be his pastor. He and his wife attended our church. They had serious marital difficulties, and they're no longer together. They're divorced. They had one child. He's 8 or 9 years old. And the email that I got from him, and I've been sort of following his story for the last year, was just about how for the last year he has been both emotionally and legally estranged from his former wife, but he is also separated from his son. The courts are not giving him any access to his son. And of course, the situation is complex. It always is. But what came through to me in the email is that, and it was day 364 when he sent me the email. On day 364, he was in such pain because he, it's hard to imagine, but he hadn't been able to see his son. He hadn't been able to speak to him. He couldn't hold him. He couldn't hug him. And he was a basket case. And over the last year, it's been very difficult for my friend. He's gone through serious depression. And while he's been depressed, he has thought very dark thoughts about what he should do with his life, if you know what I mean. There was a time when just, his body's way of dealing with his stress, he lost the ability to speak. He went mute for a time. And so when I think about what my friend is going through, and I just sort of put myself back a little bit in history to Hannah's situation, it helps me to appreciate that this was hard, especially in that culture when there is so much shame and stigma, along with all the other complications that this could create in relationships. This was very, very difficult, and we must remember this. Well, we go from suffering of barren Hannah now in verses 9 through 20 to what turns out to be a rather remarkable resolution. Oh, that all who struggle with infertility would know this kind of a resolution. But the writer tells us that, you know, there was a day when this changed. I mean, every year, you know, there was this cycle that had repeated itself. And we don't know for how many years this went on, but probably a few. But then there was this day, there was this year when it all changed. You know, again, they go down to Shiloh for this religious festival. Verses 9 through 11, they have the meal. They're all there together. The priest is even present. Hannah, of course, she is still in deep pain, and she's praying, and she's crying, and she's bitter, and she's bitter, and she's crying, and she's in pain, and praying, and all of this. It looks like it's going to be another one of those years, right? And then something happens. Something happens in the inner spirit of Hannah. She is somehow given the liberty and the freedom to pray like she has never prayed before. And she makes a vow with God. I don't know if you've ever done this. I haven't talked to the other elders. I don't know if we recommend this, but this is what happened in her case. And in verse 11, we read that all of a sudden she was emboldened to pray this prayer. And she made a vow saying, Lord Almighty, which more literally could be something like God of war, almost as if she's saying, you are the God who fights for Israel. Now I'm asking that you would be the God who fights for me. Lord Almighty, she says, if you will look on your servant's misery and remember me, and not forget your servant, but give her a son. In other words, if you will be mindful of me, then I will be mindful of you. I will give him to the Lord for all the days of his life. No razor will ever be used on his head. And that language, no razor ever be on his head, is something like, he will be totally and fully devoted and dedicated to you. And there's other background that goes with that. If you will be mindful of me, I will be mindful of you. Can we do that? She did. Well, what happened? Oh, there's one other thing I wanted to mention here. And, you know, here you have a lady whose prayer is described as she's just pouring out her heart. She's pouring out her soul. It's like, you know, think of her soul as a compartment. And she took everything that was in her soul and she emptied it. It's all on the table in prayer. God, it's all here. You can see it. And I had to ask myself this week, when was the last time I prayed like that? You know, there are things that kind of get me going. There are things that hurt me. There are things that vex me, just as there are in your life. When was the last time we took an example like this seriously? And, you know, rather than just being so polite in our prayers, our Father who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Great prayer. I think you should pray it every day. Even pray it rote. And in time, you'll start praying between the lines. And maybe it'll bring us to a place like this. But she just kind of let it all hang out. There have been times when I've said to myself, I really need to take this matter to the Lord. I really need to empty my soul in prayer to God. And then more often than not, I forget about it. And I get busy with my life. I should do this. We should do this in prayer. I don't know if we should do this in our public prayers in church, although it might be refreshing if we heard people do this. I'm not even so sure we should do it Wednesday night at the prayer time, or if you're in another prayer group, maybe that is a good time to do it. But for sure, in the privacy of our own homes or wherever it is you pray, we ought to try praying like this. Give it all to God. Maybe some of you already do this, and that's great. Well, verses 12 to 18, she has now prayed boldly. We find out, though, in this section that she's been praying silently. Her lips are moving. She's crying, very emotional, deeply moved by all this. But she's not actually, you know, it's like she turned down the audio and it's just the video. The priest, Eli, he's there, the holy man, and he's been watching. He puts two and two together, and, you know, he's a smart guy, so he figures out that this lady is praying under the influence. And so he begins to rebuke her, and he says, put away your wine, which we would say, lady, put away your booze, right? I mean, get off the bottle. What is your problem? And then she does a very bold thing. She's feeling bold. She's been emboldened, and she starts pushing back on the holy man, and she says, just hold it there a moment, buddy. This is what is going on in my life. And she doesn't go into detail, but she says, I am pouring my soul out to the Lord. It's not that I've been drinking. I am praying earnestly. And so he backs off, and instead of rebuking her, he blesses her. And he says, my mistake, go in peace. And may the God of Israel grant you what you have asked of him. And then something amazing happens. Her burden lifts. She begins to feel the return of her appetite. And her depression is gone. Something happened. It's pretty amazing, right? After years and years of this. And she goes. She goes home, verses 19 to 20. And her husband have relations. And she conceives. And she has a baby. And when they're going through all the baby name books, she's in the S's. And she comes to the name that means heard by God. Heard by God. That's the name. Heard by God. I was heard by God. We'll call him Samuel. And the name Samuel sounds like the Hebrew expression heard by God. Wow. Quite a resolution. Well, what is this story? Is it a story about God overcoming infertility? Of course it is. But it's more. I am not able to stand here today and assure every woman for whom infertility is an issue that if you pray like Hannah, the results will be this. I wish I could. There's always this Christian belief that comes into play, let your will be done. And we somehow have to factor that into all of our praying. And surely not all of the women in ancient Israel who were infertile, who prayed similar prayers, became fertile. So it is certainly a story of God overcoming infertility in this case, but it's more. It's a story of God answering an ordinary woman's prayer in such a way that not only was she blessed, but so were a whole lot of other people blessed. Because after all, who was the baby? The baby was Samuel. What did Samuel become? He became one of the greatest priests that Israel had ever known. He became one of the greatest prophets that Israel had ever known. And God spoke powerfully through him. Samuel was the man that God used to bring the nation back to God. This nation that had been painting God out of the picture. God will use him to bring a nation back. Imagine if you had that in your portfolio. I mean, it's one thing to bring a brother back. The book of James talks about how wonderful that would be if through your interaction with a brother who had been wandering, you bring him back. What if you could say, I brought my whole church back to the Lord, or I brought my whole neighborhood back to the Lord. I brought a whole province back to the Lord. I brought all of Canada back to the Lord. How many people can say God used them to bring a nation back to God? In answering Hannah's prayer, God was putting a man on the scene that he would use to do just that. Plus, he was a kingmaker to boot. He had the privilege of anointing Israel's first two kings. And one of them was Israel's greatest king, the man after God's own heart. Quite a resolution. Well, the name of the series is Be the Exception. So we should say something about being the exception. Hannah lived during the period of the judges when everyone did that which was right in their own eyes. Yet she didn't. She didn't. Everybody else did, but she didn't. She was an exception. There would be others. Just as Israel needs exceptions, so does Canada. Our Canada. 21st century Canada. The Canada that we read about on the news. The Canada that we experience. The Alberta that we experience. The Red Deer that we experience. They need exceptions as well. We're a people who habitually paint God out of the picture. What is needed? Well, for men, like Balmoral men, to be exceptions. For women, like Balmoral women, to be exceptions. For young people, even younger children can do this. Even whole faith communities can do this. Who will be the exception to the rule? This week, could I be an exception to the rule? How would I do that? Well, one way of doing it is by self-identifying as a believer wherever you go, the groups that you rub shoulders with. And there are all kinds of ways of doing this. Some of us do it, and some of us do it half the time, and some of us maybe do it more of the time. It's challenging. We were visiting a neighbor recently, had been wanting to see him for a while, and it just kind of worked out. We're walking by. That's when we have the best conversations. It's just when we're walking by, you know, structure a lot of these things, and the guy's got quite the green thumb, so he wanted to show us the garden. So we went back there, and we're looking at everything and oohing and aahing. And I don't know, something came up in the conversation, and I just felt, I don't know whose hands were, you know, pushing on me. Well, kind of, but I just felt like, well, you ought to self-identify. You ought to identify yourself as a Christian. How are you going to do that? So the topic came up, and I said, you know, there's somebody in the church that I attend who also does such and such and knows about this and this. And I just injected God into the conversation. A little bit later on, he made a comment about something, and it sounded a lot like something in the Bible. And I just again felt like, you know what? Why don't you just build a bridge? Go fishing. Go searching a little bit. And I, you know, I said, that sounds a lot like something that a Hebrew poet in the Old Testament had to say, la, 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 la. And nobody was biting that day, but I just felt like I needed to self-identify. And maybe that's one of the ways that we start to do this with the people that we're with and the circumstances that we find ourselves in, that we just identify ourselves as part of a people of faith. And maybe that's the first step to some other conversations. Or maybe that's a way of signaling to people around us that, you know what, I'm actually one of those Christian-type people. And maybe someday we can go a little bit further with that. Sadly, I don't always do that. There are times when I let opportunity slip through my fingers. But I think I'm learning. I think I'm learning. And then, of course, after you've self-identified as a believer, now you have an obligation to behave like it. And that can be the hardest. Talk is cheap. But they both go hand in hand. And we're going to meet a lot of people like this. Maybe not a lot, but we are going to meet people in the book of Samuel who were the exception. So I'm going to be praying, and I hope you will be praying. I'm going to be praying for myself, and I want to be praying for Balmoral, that we increasingly, in this culture that seems to be drifting further and further away from God, that we will be those who, like bright lights, the bright lights of Ruth and the bright light of Samuel and Hannah, will be people who are exceptions to the rule. Let's pray. Well, Father, we thank you that you love us. You loved us enough to become one of us, to come and live among us in Jesus Christ, your Son and our Savior. And we thank you for his example and for his willingness to at times be the exception in his culture. As we think about this story of Hannah and the pain that she experienced and the hardship that she went through, we are amazed that she continued to put her faith and trust in you. And I pray that you would help each of us, whatever the difficulties are that we face, that we would show ourselves to be exceptional believers, that we would be those who trust in you and look to you. We trust you for the outcome. And we thank you that so often when you answer our prayers, that it's not only our prayers that you're answering, but the prayers and you're addressing the needs of others in our larger circle. And that's pretty neat. And so we do ask that you would continue to work among us. We pray that increasingly we would be willing to embrace Christ before men, and that those that we encounter, that we would have the opportunity of not pointing the finger, but pointing the way, and pointing the way to the one who is the way, the truth, and the life. We pray through Christ. Amen.